Hey, I feel like coffee, but I'd be worried about it.
I guess I don't have it. Read a couple of paragraphs from a section of Moby Dick, which is pure poetry. It's chapter 92, called Ambergris, and ambergris is the substance from which perfumes and various vintages used to be made. And Melville writes of the experience of being there bent over tubs and tubs of this ambergris, and they have to squeeze it with their hands to keep it from clotting up and pulping up. And he writes, "Who would think, then, that such fine ladies and gentlemen should regale themselves with an essence found in the inglorious bowels of a sick whale? Yet so it is. By some, ambergris is supposed to be the cause, and by others the effect, of the dyspepsia in the whale. How to cure such a dyspepsia, it would be hard to say, unless by administering 3 or 4 boatloads of Brandreth's pills and then running out of harm's way, as laborers do in blasting rock. Oh, and I had forgotten to say that there were found in this ambergris certain hard, round, bony plates, which at first I thought might be sailors' trousers buttons, but it after a while turned out that they were nothing more than pieces of small squid bones embalmed in that matter. Now that incorruption of this most fragrant ambergris should be found in the heart of such decay, is this not nothing? Bethink thee of that saying of St. Paul in the Corinthians about corruption and incorruption, how that we are sown in dishonor but raised in glory. And likewise call to mind that saying of Paracelsus about what it is that maketh the best musk. And also forget not the strange fact that of all things of ill savor, cologne water in its rudimental manufacturing stages is the worst." And so then he goes on to talk about squeezing this ambergris. And he writes, "As I sat there at my ease, cross-legged on the deck after the bitter exertion at the windlass, under a blue, tranquil sky, the ship under indolent sail, and gliding so serenely along as I bathed my hands among those soft, gentle globules of infiltrated tissues, wove almost within the hour, as they richly broke to my fingers and discharged all their opulence, like fully ripe grapes their wine, as I stuffed up that uncontaminated aroma, literally and truly like the smell of spring violets, I declare to you that for the time I lived as in a musky meadow, I forgot all about our horrible oath. In that inexpressible, spermy substance, I washed my hands and my heart of it. I almost began to credit the old Paracelsian superstition that sperm is of rare virtue in allaying the heat of anger. While bathing in that bath, I felt divinely free of all ill will and petulance or malice of any sort whatsoever. Squeeze, 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 all the morning long. I squeezed till I myself almost melted into it. I squeezed till a strange sort of insanity came over me, and I found myself unwittingly squeezing my co-laborers' hands in it, mistaking their hands for the gentle globules. Such an abounding, friendly, loving feeling did this avocation beget that at last I was continually squeezing and looking up, and eyes were filled sentimentally as much to say, oh, my dear fellow being, why should we longer cherish any social acerbities or know the slightest ill humor or envy? Come, let us squeeze and squeeze human kindness. Would that I would keep squeezing forever." And then he has, "In my thoughts of the visions of the night, I saw long rows of angels in paradise, each with his hands in a jar of spermaceti." This beatific vision comes, of course, just before the final interlock, where the Pequod and its crew, having made that unholy pact with the cab, are forever committed to trying to kill the final object of their quest. And this is, of course, the exact process that we usually find ourselves in when we are living a life, especially conscientiously, bringing symbolism into our vision. We find ourselves more and more in the position of trying to draw up for ourselves schemata and diagrams of order by which we seek to remember constantly in our living and try to apply the various schemata and so forth to situations which by their own nature are flowing in certain patterns and designs. And by X-ing out that which does not fit in, we hope to recreate somehow, through our symbolic vision, some sense of what it is that we have dreamed of in our aspirations, in our minds, and of course this is exactly the wrong process, one which leads increasingly to wishful thinking on one hand, to wish for a kind of a more simplistic world or a more simplistic kind of a personality, situation, whatever it is, making it easier to transform these wonderful mental ideas of order onto reality and thus corral, shape them according to the way in which we would like. But of course, as we're seeing, all the examples that we have in process here show the lie of this approach. And the opposite to that, contrapositive, really, is that as we develop a field of inquiry and we add on experience of the child, we add on, in Mr. Hall's book, say, the article on Isis or on Pythagoras, or we bring in something from the book of Hopi, or we have Moby Dick, or we have in slides like tonight, we're going to have a few slides of William Blake, Dante, an example of a symbolical journey. As we develop a field of inquiry, our process is not to fit it into any particular scheme whatsoever, but rather to enrich that field of inquiry. And the important part, not yet underscored, is that this suspension is something which takes place over a duration of what we would call time. And at certain opportune junctures, there are patterns, not from our mind, but patterns in the flow of events, which make connections for us and make various kinds of continuities and parallels occur to us and precipitate out of this solution of experience, shape and form. You may find something from the ceremony from the Hopis correlating with something from one of the aspects of Isis with something that you've read in Moby Dick, and perhaps a concept from the Tao. And out of that will come a shape, which will be a shape of your experience integrated with the conscious structuring of imagery and the conscious adoption of ideas with rather universal patterns which we do not structure, but which are there. They are given. They are in operation. And whatever shapes come out, of course, whatever resolutions come out of this solution, those are the templates of vision. Those are the orientations, the compasses, the guides. Those are the inner stars. And as they collect in the living process, the real constellation, the real celestial scope of our own existence comes more and more into the natural floor that we recognize that the shapings which we find for ourselves occur in others. Both those who, like ourselves, are companions in a quest together in a situation like this, or we find great affinity with people in other ages or other cultures and times. And as this kind of paralleling occurs more and more, we realize that we have got ourselves on the path, that we have come into a recognizable realm of spiritual experience, and that its staging, its unfolding, its paddling forth to fullness have patterns which dwarf any of the kinds of cookie cutter categorical conceptions which the mind can dream of. They simply fall by comparison and fall by the wayside. In symbolical journey, which is really the specific topic tonight, and Moby Dick as our great example of one, we constantly find ourselves in a position of trying to understand what it is that we're doing. And the temptation, of course, is to try to come to some intellectual conclusion, and it's almost always prematurely, because the impulse, the impetus to integrate is a constant with us, and as soon as we begin to attenuate our senses and mature it beyond the natural base, beyond the simply ritualistic base, and even beyond the mythological language base to the symbolic, the natural occurrence is to try and bring something together. And this is where the sense of time becomes very valuable, because it may not be for many months or many years until the full reverberation of the means which are maturing in ourselves become apparent. And if we are carrying within us a particular ideological prejudice, a certain kind of a categorical formation which we prefer beyond all others, we tend to structure the perception of our integration along those lines, thus seeming to confirm our own intelligence and our own initial supposition. Whereas the other process, letting chaos be chaos, letting unknown remain unknown, letting experience which has not yet resolved itself into anything stable or aligned itself with anything parallel, but simply observing it, adding it to the field of inquiry, to the spectrum of what it is that we are entertaining in our perception, in our conception, in our mobility, letting that be there, letting it enrich. There's a famous dictum from Vicerronius' procedure. It was called the categorical imperative, originated by a man who we mentioned two meetings ago, Immanuel Kant, that before we do anything, we must ask the question, what if everyone did this? And of course, very often the answer is, if everyone did this, this would be a very terrible thing. So we do not do. And the list of don'ts and should nots and do nots from this kind of attitude grows very long, very ponderous, very complex. On the other side of this is something which might even be called, designated the existential imperative, what if no one did this? And quite often, the answer to that is that the universe would be minus a value, that the field of an inquiry would be lessened, not enriched. And so the temptation constantly And of course, when we have before us a complete cycle of learning, as is in Mr. Hall's great work here, and we have a chance, as we're having it here, to at least survey some of this great grand circle of meaning. It's very easy for us to forget it, to try to find an insight that takes us to the center, from which then any aspect of this could be illuminated, and to try and take something which we dream of, or we manufacture, or someone else manufactures and we adopt, and try to impress it on the circle of learning, hoping then that everything will clear up, and that which doesn't clear up must not be valuable, and we can dispense with it, throw it away. Hence, the quality of greatness in the book is that it is a far-flung cycle. You will find 20, 25 traditions, and all of them are valuable. All of them are necessary, because it is the completeness of this cycle that is valuable to us, because it affords us the farthest possible spread of a field of inquiry. We may look at anything, at any time, anywhere, with value. Now, as far as Moby Dick, Melville's great symbolical journey here has been chosen because it complements an area of the great book which, without something like the perspective of Moby Dick, would remain hidden, and thus we use it to disclose. And that is, there is such a difference between the old world and the new world, between Europe, Northern Africa, and Asia Minor, which formed a continuous civilization for some 7,000 or 8,000 years, and the New World, which has just a small few paltry centuries of recorded history. And of course, we're not doing disservice to the American Indians. We've mentioned that many times, of their antiquity. But the case in point is that for the kind of mind which we have, using a language which is European, as English is, remember we talked about the language types in North America, and about the fact that California alone had 20 different language families before any peoples of European descent came here, and that was more linguistic diversity than all of the European continents. But the fact is, old world, new world, there is something distinctive about the new world and about the quality of mind and the quality of experience which that mind can comfortably entertain, which highlights and complements the old world. And most of the traditions in the secret teachings belong to the old world. I guess that quality could best be summed up. The title in the book here from Yale University Press, the book is kind of pedantic, it isn't very good, but the title is good. It's called Wilderness and the American Mind, Wilderness. And Moby Dick has within its scope a fantastic appreciation for the world as largely an unknown, something which has never been subjected to any of these categories of imposition. And therefore, the world is rather like a joker than any particular card or sequence of cards in a deck. It is unknown. It can play any part. And even the game, the name of the game, is unknown. The notion of wilderness, the fact that the time that this was written, about 130 years ago, 1850, even most of the continental USA, California of course was a state, but most of the continental USA was still terra incognita to 99% of the population. But the inroads were coming. The development was plain to see, and there were people like Melville or Gauguin or Robert Louis Stevenson who tried to flee to the primitive condition of man before it was spoiled, try to achieve an experience of Eden before it was lost forever. About the time just before Moby Dick was written, for instance, and this was on everyone's mind, but for instance, Washington Irving, very urbane American writer who loved his East Coast very well, but had gone to Europe and spent about 17 or 18 years there, suddenly felt this great nostalgia that he had never seen the American West. And so he left the grandeur of the Alhambra, he left the excellence of London, came rushing back to the United States, immediately set out on this great expedition, and he wrote a book called The Tour of the Prairies. And in it was the most startling kinds of revelations for him and statements to say. He said if man wants to mature, he shouldn't go to Europe at all, but he should go out to where he matured, into the wilderness, because there's some quality there which calls forth that essential nature, that quintessential presence in a new way, a new shape, and of course that shape is always the one which we can contribute, which we can engender, which we can harbor. And so it is that at that time and since, and even up to today, the American mind in particular, as a spiritual experiencing questioner, prefers to have unknown, prefers to have a horizon of unlimitedness. And so in Moby Dick we find an example of this kind of opportunity. I wanted to present Moby Dick to you in a way which I felt was something which you could not get to yourself, would never have an experience of. And so I decided to use this kind of attack to illuminate it. You can experience the book on your own, and you will, whether it's this year or next year or 5 years from now. The kinds of images that are in process now will simply surface again and again and become more and more meaningful. But here's a text that I don't think any of you would have access to, and so I'll give it to you. If you've noticed, the book is dedicated to a friend of his, Nathaniel Hawthorne, another very great American writer. And when the book was being written in the 1850-1851, even for a while, Hawthorne lived just on the other side of a mountain in Massachusetts from Melville, and they used to visit back and forth. And they hadn't been friends before then. And there is a series of letters from Melville to Hawthorne, which have survived. And I've excerpted out about 6 or 7 paragraphs from a series of letters that cover the time of the composition of Moby Dick to the man to whom it was dedicated to, and has within it the kind of germinal experience that Melville was expressing so well in Moby Dick, that it begins in a great, wide, open camaraderie, and in its grand, hermetic circling, comes into contact with all the great issues, and then comes to a beautiful resolving, almost a precipitating of form to Melville at the end, where I think you'll appreciate what he has to say. First excerpt is from a letter dated the 29th of January, 1851, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And this is just sort of a beginning of a friendship between Melville and Hawthorne. But remember that in the background, on Melville's work table, is this book and all the concerns in it. And increasingly to him, the realization that he had, as we saw last week, Moochie's Dragon, He had Muji's dragon by the tail. And in order to hold that dragon, well, you have to be the complement. You have to become the tiger on the shore. Remember those images. So this is quite an interesting letter. A few excerpts. As I said before, I will send my best traveling chariots and runners, and it will be at your door, and provision made not only for accommodation, but also for any quantity of baggage. The word welcome all the time will be in my mouth, so be ready the very instant you cross the threshold. Another thing, do you not think that you're coming to any prim or nonsensical house that is nonsensical in the ordinary way? You must be bored with such punctilious people. You may do what you please, say or say not what you please. And if you feel any inclination for that sort of thing, you may spend the period of your visit in bed if you like, every hour of your visit. But mark, there's some excellent Montanado sherry awaiting you, and some most potent port. We'll have mulled wine with wisdom, and buttered toast with storytelling, and crack jokes and bottles from morning till night. So come, and if you don't, I will send constables after you. So the beginning. The next letter, dated the 12th of February, about 2 weeks later. And this one is the only one in the sequence that's not to Melville, but to his brother-in-law, Everett Dusnik. And he writes here, "After a long procrastination, I drove down to see Mr. Hawthorne a couple of weeks ago. I found him, of course, buried in snow, and the delightful scenery about him, all wrapped up and tucked away under a napkin, as it were. He was to have made me a day's visit. I had promised myself much pleasure in getting him up in my snug room here and discussing the universe with a bottle of brandy and cigars. But he has not been able to come, owing to sickness in his family, or else he's up to the lips in the universe again." A little telling paragraph, almost that. The next letter in this sequence is the 16th of April, about 2 months later. He must have had his table piled high with Moby Dick at that time. A little something from April 16th, 1851. He's talking about the problem of character and creating literary character. And this is Clifford from the House of Seven Gables. Clifford is full of an awful truth throughout. He is conceived in the finest, truest spirit. He is no caricature. He is Clifford. And here we would say that, did circumstances permit, we should like nothing better than to devote an elaborate and careful paper to the full consideration and analysis of the purport and significance of what so strongly characterizes all this author's writing as a certain tragic phase of humanity, which in our opinion was never more powerfully embodied than by Hawthorne. We mean the tragicalness of human thought in its own unbiased, naive, and profounder working. We think that into no recorded mind has the intense feeling of the visible truth ever entered more deeply than into this man. By visible truth, we mean the apprehension of the absolute condition of present things as they strike the eye of the man who fears them not, though they do their worst to him. Well, that sounds like Job. That sounds like the wisdom of the lesson of Job. A little bit later on in this sequence, this is from this is a letter to Hawthorne dated the 1st of June, 1851. About 6 weeks after that. He's talking about how Hawthorne's reputation is one of a very careful writer, while he's being remembered for a book that he wrote called Typee, and he says, "But to go down to posterity is bad enough anyway, but to go down as a man who lived among cannibals. When I speak of posterity in reference to myself, I only mean the babies who will probably be born in the moment immediately ensuing upon my giving up the ghost, and I shall go down to some of them in all likelihood. I'll be given to them with their gingerbread. I've begun to regard this matter of fame as the most transparent of all vanities. I read Solomon more and more. And every time, see deeper and deeper and unspeakable meanings in him. I did not think of fame a year ago as I do now. My development has been all within a few years past. I am like one of those seeds taken out of the Egyptian pyramid, which after 3,000 years of being a seed and nothing but a seed, then planted into English soil, developed by itself, grew to greenness. That was the first beginning. By now he's probably about a third of the way through residence. Later on, same month, same person writing to Hawthorne. Until I was 25, I had no development at all. But from my 25th year, I date my life. He was 30 years old when he was writing this letter. He did nothing until he was 25. And he says, suddenly at 25, I date my life. 3 weeks have scarcely passed at any time between then and now that I have not unfolded within myself. But I feel that I am now come to the inmost leaf of the bulb, and that shortly the flower must fall to the mold. It seems to me now that Solomon was the truest man who ever spoke, and yet that he a little managed the truth with a view to popular conservatism. I've been reading Goethe's sayings, so worshipped by his votaries, and I came across this, quote, live in the all. That is to say, your separate identity is but a wretched one. Good, but get out of yourself, spread and expand yourself, and bring to yourself the tinglings of life that are felt in the flowers and the woods, that are felt in the planets Saturn and Venus and the fixed stars. What nonsense. Here's a fellow with a raging toothache. My dear boy, Goethe says to him, you are sorely afflicted with that tooth, but you must live in the all, and then you will be happy. And Novo writes, to Hawthorne, as with all great genius, there is an immense deal of flummery in Goethe, and in proportion to my own contact with him, a monstrous deal of it in me. You see, he's centering in on this kind of a form of experience wherein the old modeling, the old styling, have dissolved. They have no place. A little bit later on, the end of June, 1851, to Hawthorne. He incidentally called Moby Dick the whale, all the way through on the thread. Because, shall I send you a fin of the whale, which by way of a specimen mouthful, the tail is not yet cooked, though the hellfire in which the whole book is broiled might not unreasonably have cooked it all ere this. And this is the book's motto, the secret one, of course. Ego non batisto te enomen, but make the rest up for yourself. And of course, the phrasing comes from the wonderful Latin, I baptize you in the name of the Father, and so forth, but Melville has changed it here. And of course, the sequence in Moby Dick, where all the harpooners are gathered together by Ahab, and of course the structure is almost like a perfect self symbol. You want to shift to your perspective is temporal, which is sort of a union typology, just to give you some kind of an ideational image. If you have Ahab as the captain, and you have as his immediate counterpoint, Slab, he's the third mate, and over here on your right hand side, Starbuck. And his counterpoint is Scott. And the captain, you know, the first mate, the second mate, and the third mate. And Queequeg, some of you have long this sort of thing, and you've been waiting, I suppose, for some of these things. These are notable things. I put very little stock in this sort of thing. This is good to add to our field of inquiry.
replaced, and then stuff has to go. And Flans has got to do. These are the harpooners. And because all stealth symbols, whenever they manifest, they're always complete, they're the complement to Ahab. Queequeg is the primitive to start on. Dagobah is the primitive flat. Tastico is the primitive to stealth. And the primitive to Ahab is Moon Cabin 1 and 6. Because Ahab's egotism, his cookie-cutter capacity to stamp the world with himself only, is extended to such a point that the unconscious expression of his confidence is but a little cabin boy, and not anyone who would be a harpooner of capable of going after whales. And of course, poor Pip, being cosmically parallel to Ahab, as Nobel says, the story of lived out a billion years before these oceans rose. And Pip, characteristic to that kind of squeezed, demented, unconscious, falls into the ocean, and as Melville says, as he goes down under the water, that he must have seen God's foot on the treadle of creation. He went so far down. In this world, of course, the Pequod itself, as the ship, holds them together. And that person who is free to meander around the whole position, the one who is free by virtue that he isn't included in the structure. He's not a part of the plan. He's left out, superfluous. Of course, he's the one who survived. He's the one who is not caught in the tragic net. And getting back now, bringing back to the point which we were holding in suspension, the Latin of I baptize thee in the name of the Father, which was changed in Moby Dick, is where Ahab brings together the three harpooners. And they take off the harpoon head. And they fill the cavity left there. And they toast themselves to the fact that they will, regardless of whatever happens, go with Ahab in quest of killing Moby Dick, and that is the only thing in the world that counts. And that they swear a holy, or rather unholy, fraternity. And of course, this is like a black mass. This is like a black Sabbath. This is a going against nature, in the sense that this kind of a formation is not a part of the natural flow and ebb, but is an imposition from the outside. And of course, it has always a tragic denouement, as the Greeks called it, a final fall. A little bit later, this is November 7th, this is a letter to his brother-in-law again. He says, your letter received last night had a sort of stunning effect on me. For some days past, being engaged in the woods with axe and wedge, the whale had almost completely slipped me for the time, and I was the merrier for it. When, crash, comes Moby Dick himself, as you might justly say, reminds me of what I have been about for part of the last year or two. It is really and truly a surprising coincidence, to say the least. I make no doubt that it is Moby Dick himself, for there is no account of his capture after the sad fate of the Pequod about 14 years ago. Ye gods, what a commentator is this Anne Alexander Whale. What he has to say is short and pithy and very much to the point. I wonder if my evil art has raised this monster. And of course, this is not immediately apparent to you because you're not adjusted finally to these kinds of subtleties. But what he's saying here is that he has created
in this book not a fiction, but a reality which enters into our reality, has that capacity, so much so that it is a part of our experience as if we had lived it ourselves. It's a part of our background, can become a part of our reality just as surely as any experience that we've ever had. Now that's a very peculiar thing, because the mind which seeks its solace in these kinds of images which it imposes on the world would rather conceive of things in terms of fiction and non-fiction, something which you just have, you read for entertainment, or something which you read for data or information. But that's a false distinction. And neither of those two qualities ever obtain. It's never purely data, and it's never purely fiction. But we're rather adding to field of inquiry and having experienced the symbolical journey, like Moby Dick, fully, is all the same in terms of reality as if we ourselves had lived through that. Faulkner, when he discovered it, said that he set his bottle of Jack Daniels down and he said he had discovered that literary figures cast shadows. And he never again wrote a word that he didn't mean. Because just as Melville was beginning to realize here, so after he'd sent the manuscript off, that he had created something in reality, not just a book, not just a fiction. And all symbolical journeys have a way of coming to birth, of having their genesis and creating the form. And we may take those journeys, not simply allegorically, and not simply in the mode of just something which is entertaining or curious, but for real. I love the children's phrase "for real" because it is a beautiful way to state the prepositional import of what it is that we've really opened ourselves up to. That is to say, all symbolical journeys can add to our actual living reality. The last letter in this sequence, this of course was written again to Hawthorne about 2 days later. And he writes,